Ian Williams, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. It's kind of an America's Cup special we're trying to do here. We've both been following the four races of the Cup so far. I've been getting up in the middle of the night to follow it live, and you've been watching the reruns in the morning before you do the school run. So we're in a bit of a good position to have a little discussion about this 36th America's Cup. And I wanted to start by just asking you what your thoughts have been on in general about this Cup. It's been different to other Cups, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, thanks, Justin, for having me on. It's been a really interesting Cup. As you say, it's been, you know, I guess that's the beauty of the America's Cup is it does change, particularly each time you get a new defender. They bring their own stamp. They do what they want to do. It's obviously a new class of boat. That's the biggest change. And it's been really, really interesting. I think the boats have been overall good. They've provided very good tactical racing. The shame of the last Cup is that the guys didn't have enough oil and they were heavily restricted with what they could do just because they were running out of power. And that was, you know, in hindsight, of course, I would say an error in the way it was, the boats were designed. They've obviously seen that and addressed it with the batteries this time. And I think it makes for really, really interesting tactical racing.
So you're a fan of the AC75s? It's very different to the AC50s that we saw last time, which were pretty impressive in their own way.
I am a fan of them. I think they're super cool boats. You know, I love the technical side. I'm not sure they are that different to the 50s, other than, you know, in terms of the spectacle and what you see. They're both technical boats. They're both very fast boats, obviously. They're both foiling. As I said, the big difference is the amount of, well, the amount of power they have because of the batteries, which allows them to do more tactically. So I think you would have seen something similar if they carried on with catamarans. Of course, there's nuances, you know, around the catamaran platform and the monohull, but I see those as a similar sort of approach, as opposed to the other approach that you could take, which is to put the boats back in the water, make them much, much less complex, obviously a lot slower, and have, you know, slower, more traditional type of match racing.
That's a big move, though, isn't it, to make? I can already hear people squealing around the world at the thought of moving back from foiling, and in particular the sailors, because the sailors seem very committed to foiling now.
Yeah, I can imagine being part of these teams. I bet the boats are incredibly interesting and exciting to sail. No doubt about that. I think the foiling dimension adds a huge amount to the technical, both the design, but also actually the sailing skill involved with sailing them. So I can certainly imagine that the guys involved now wouldn't want to go back. I think the benefits of going to the less complex boat is simply more teams. That's the main benefit of it. And I think it's pretty indisputable that you would get more teams, but, you know, is you could call it dumbing down. Is that the right way to go? I'm not sure. I think there's pros and cons with both options. I guess the one other thing is the sail handling that some particular people miss. Those guys that do that a lot in their, you know, in their own sailing and work a lot on their sail handling are probably missing the old days. But I think you really got to weigh up what you want. Do you want it at the technical edge with the foiling? To do that, you probably end up with less teams.
For me, I think it has to be at the technical edge of things. And for those fans of the old days and the lots of boat handling and sail handling, they don't have to go much further than to take a look at the videos the World Match Racing Tour are posting on Facebook right now. There's some absolute thrillers. The boats are conventional monohulls. Some of them are kind of almost cruiser racer style boats, but the boat on boat action is just thrilling. And you've been a huge part of that over the years. I mean, that's where people should go for that action, isn't it?
Well, maybe. I guess now, certainly some of the old stuff's got a lot of views that I've seen, and they've been digging out all the archives of Coots against Gilmore, and so they've gone back quite. Sorry if those guys here, but they've gone back quite a long time to dig that out. No, absolutely. I think we can talk all we liked, aren't we? Until you win the thing, you don't get to decide. It's going to be up to either Lunarossa or Team New Zealand to decide the way they want to go. You know, there's a natural inertia in America's Cup because whoever wins it is the best in the type of boat that they're doing at the time, and there's obviously a natural reluctance to change anyway. I would probably expect them to carry on with the same class. You know, either team if they were to win, why wouldn't you?
A few tweaks, possibly, if we do continue with this class for the next event. What are your thoughts around the lack of passing that's been going on and the kind of briefness of the pre-start? Would you change that? Would you widen things out a bit, maybe create some more passing lanes and extend that pre-start zone?
Yeah, I would. I think whenever you have the apparent so far forward, you're always going to have an advantage to the lead boat. Up and downwind, I think that's the big change. There was always an advantage upwind. Now you've got that advantage downwind as well. I think the fact that boats tack very well actually helps a lot. Traditionally, if the boats tack badly, then if you can make the opposition do one or two extra, then it was obviously very costly. And I think we saw that today. Day two. Particularly in the lighter airs, the tack loss looked still pretty significant. It was, 50 to 70 meters of tack loss. So if you can make the opposition do two more tacks, you know, then it's quite a big change. So in terms of the boats, I think, yeah, trying to keep reducing that tack loss, I think, is a big part of opening up overtaking opportunities. I think I don't really like the boundaries. I think they reduce the chance of overtaking. If you can, you normally have to spend a tack to get a split. And having done that and made the loss, you then get forced to come back because you hit the boundary so soon. So, it does. I think it reduces the opportunity for the trailing boat to overtake. But it also, in my mind, it adds a little bit more luck because you can't control a favored side. You can split to what you think is the favored side, but then you hit the boundary, get bounced back, and the other guy then gets the favored side. And so, you know, my experience of sailing with the boundaries is I feel it's, I guess it puts the emphasis back more on the handling and the speed. It's hard to really make those sort of tactical decisions count for picking a side. I'm not a big fan of the boundaries. And I actually noticed that the spectators were lined up in a diamond shape today anyway. So the argument that they need the boundaries for the spectators sort of goes out the window a little bit there as well. And then the pre-start, there's been a lot of talk about extending the pre-start maybe to 3 minutes. You could do that, and then that would give time for the boats to circle, and you probably would see some circling. I think they probably did when they decided on 2 minutes, they didn't know if they were going to be able to circle, but we've seen some videos of teams doing that. If you extended it to 2:30 even, it would bring the balance back more even between the starboard and the port entry. At the moment, the 2 minutes with the port entry boat crossing, jibing at around 1:10, it's just not quite long enough. That lead follow then becomes not quite long enough for the other boat to either lead back and waste the time or push back, it seems. I think there will be some options. I don't think we're going to see the port entry boat win every race in this America's Cup, but I think there's little doubt that it is definitely an advantage to be entering on port. And I just did I think that if it does go with the port entry boat, I think that means Team New Zealand get the last port entry, although I haven't actually seen that written out in the instructions. Just that was me projecting forward, so I thought that was interesting.
I must admit, I was just thinking that a few hours ago before I went to bed, having stayed up and watched the racing and written a report about it. I did wonder if we go race for race like this, who ends up with the last one. So we will check that.
It looks to me that way. But you know, as I say, I don't think every race will go with the port entry. I think the lighter the air, the bigger the advantage to the port entry is. So a bit more wind, maybe, you know, early next week, will even that up. And of course, if they, you know, with them in level one now restrictions, as I understand it, that allows them to come back to the closer to shore inner courses, which presumably will also make for more shifty conditions and mix things up a bit.
Yeah, I think we'd all welcome that. As great as the racing is, and I've enjoyed virtually every race of this whole America's Cup. Even when there's no lead changes, there's still lots going on the boats. And actually, this just brings up one thing I just want to mention, is that the races are quite short. They're only 20, 25 minutes. But actually, you need quite a lot of time to watch them, because you need to watch them once live, and you need to go back and watch them from the stern cam of each boat, because there's some fascinating chat on the boats going on that you miss on the main broadcast. And then there's possibly a fourth time to watch, just to try and pick up all the nuances of it. So there's a lot going on out there, isn't there?
Yeah, I agree with you. There is a lot. I guess that's a little bit the challenge with covering our sport always. You know, you want a broadcaster that can try and bring all those different elements into the live broadcast. But rather them than me, it's not easy to do. It's not a criticism. It's more, you know, it's more an opportunity, I think, going forward, that to learn, you know, what those moments are, when it's good to listen into the chat on board, you know, when you can focus on what you can see of the sail trim and the manoeuvres, et cetera. Not easy.
Now, Ian, I wanted to just ask you, before we get into the nitty gritty of the America's Cup racing that we've seen, just for your kind of general feel on match racing and your approach to match racing, because I think when we hear the phrase match racing, we think of lots of circling and tacking and boats pointing head to wind and maybe going backwards and all of that close quarters stuff. But that's only really part of it. And I've heard you in the past say that, you know, your strategy is more about sailing cleanly and fast and trying not to engage until you have to. Is that a fair description of your approach to match racing and your success in it?
I think if you want to be consistently winning races, the way to do that is to start on the favoured side and go the right way, go fast. You know, if you can have a speed edge, then it becomes very, match racing becomes very, very easy. You know, if you can be equal speed and go the right way and force the other guy to go the wrong way, then again, it's reasonably simple. So for me, getting into the game of trying to put penalties on or trying to clear out, hold the other boat away from the start, sure, that can work. And you, if there are opportunities to do that, you should take them. But you're getting in to fine judgments, you know, fine swing calls, you know, judgments of the umpires. For me, that's not controlling the racing. It's easier to control a race in a more, you know, relaxed, simpler fashion. And if that's available, then that's a better percentage move.
I think we've seen a bit of that over the races in this final match series, the four races. Once one boat is ahead, the teams have done a pretty good job of sailing cleanly, controlling things, hard covers when they need to, but also sailing their own race when they get the chance to do that.
Yeah, it's been interesting, hasn't it? Between, you know, the choice between splitting and covering is always a tricky one. I always think if you're not sure which way to go, then cover. If you're confident in the way you're going, then why not take the split and make the gain? I also think with the gates, I think a lot of it is trying to line up for the favored gate. It's quite tricky to do, but I think with the amount of technology they have on board, they know pretty early on which is the favored gate. And if you can approach the top gates on opposite tacks as the lead boat, having made the other boat do one more tack, and if you're approaching the favored gate, you're going to make another jump at the gate, and they're going to have a tricky choice of whether to go straight to an unfavored gate or tack to the favored one, and they will almost always go straight and take the split. But that's another gain. And I also think, as a rule, the favored gate at the top mark tends to work out well, because you do the short jibe early and then you jibe onto the long jibe for the majority of the run, and it seems to sort of set you up pretty well for the run as well.
It's quite reassuring to me, and I don't know about you, but to hear the chat on board the boats, when you do listen from the stern cams and you're just listening to an individual boat, the chat is quite familiar to anybody who's been on race boats. It's, despite all of this technology, it's generally about wind shifts and one and in, and you know, a little more pressure on this side or whatever. I find that really reassuring.
Yeah, the tactical loop, of course, is where's the pressure and what's the shift. And likewise, the speed loop is more about, well, let's go a little faster here, let's go a little slower, and you know, the guys know what they need to do that. I guess they're not so much discussing the details of what they do to achieve that, as opposed to just what mode they're looking for, as you say. So just like our normal racing.
That's right. So let's take a look at the four races that we've seen so far, two on Wednesday and two today, Friday for us in Europe. The races have been split evenly. It started with the Kiwis taking a win in the first race, and it's fair to say most of them have been sorted out pretty early on in the whole sequence. There isn't a lot to talk about after the first half of the first beat. But that first race, Ian, we saw a mistake from Jimmy Spithill, maybe in pulling the trigger on the start line. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll talk about the Luff, which he's been reasonably heavily criticised for. But what did you see in that first start?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think as we've discussed already, the port entry boat, they get to pick their time back to the line, and it does put pressure on the other boat to try and make something happen. In this one, I thought Luna Rossa did a sensible thing, lead back. I think maybe they were a little bit, with the conditions, feeling they probably weren't expecting to have a speed edge, put it that way. So they were more under pressure to try and make something happen maybe in the pre-start. And as a rule, that leading back option there is more likely to create a win or loss for one of the boats. I thought they did a nice job. I was impressed with how Team New Zealand managed to sail a high slow mode off them, between about 40 and 10 seconds to go, which they did not achieve so well in the lighter today or day two. But yeah, I think it all set up pretty well. Critical was the trigger pull on the line. Clearly Team New Zealand, nailed that, and Luna Rossa didn't. In fairness to Jimmy, it was a tough spot. He's got the ley line for the pin end and running out of space coming up. He's also got a boat behind him that might go for a hook, so he's got to keep an eye on them. And he's also got to judge the line. And that's the challenge, is that if you're leading back a little early, you've got a lot going on. If you absolutely nail it, then it can be very strong. But it's very difficult. It's a difficult spot to be. For sure. I thought just going back a bit, interesting in the Prada Cup final, I thought Luna Rossa with their trigger pulls were certainly more conservative than Ineos. And I don't know whether that's just because they were very confident in their boat and knew that they would draw it back, or whether they are not that confident in their software timing, etc. I think over the course of this America's Cup, we'll probably find out the answer to that. You know, are they going to be able to hit the line, bang on, full speed?
So there were, I mean, I don't know if you know if you could even measure it, but let's call it a second late there. The Team New Zealand boat was to windward, you know, seemed to have some more pace, and they'd pull the trigger earlier. And they were, it was obvious they were going to roll over the top. And you heard Jimmy start to say, you know, we can't live here. We're going to need to bail out. And then kind of change his mind and say, oh, well, actually, there's a luff in this. Now, what were you thinking when you heard that? Did it look like that to you?
Well, it's really interesting. I think it's unfair to criticize any helmsman. He's probably only done one of these before, which was the one on Ineos I think it was in the round robin, actually, last race of the round robin. He was in an equally weak position then, and he achieved it. With the boundaries around the boat and the fact that the windward boat helmsman doesn't have a great view, although, you know, I was hearing the commentary talking about they have a camera maybe with a video, but even so, you might catch him out with the boundaries as well. And I think we've seen, you know, the analysis from the umpires. I think there was only a meter clear. And a meter's a decent amount, but I think it was closer than it looked, put it that way. So I'm loath to criticize somebody for what in hindsight was an error, when they haven't had any opportunity really to practice it and learn as to, you know, when you can get away with it and when you can't. And would it have affected, you know, if, put it this way, say it was a 20% chance of working out, would you take it now? I would. You know, if you hadn't done it, they were going to lose the race anyway, I suspect. So, you know, I'm loath to criticize him for that. But back to the start, I think it's not only who hits the line first, it is the speed. I think Team New Zealand, I think my recollection is they had about 2 knots advantage. And that, you know, that 2 knot advantage lasts until both boats are up to speed. So if they're hitting the line at 25 knots and then building up to 35, then you've got quite a long time of being 2 knots faster. And two knots might not sound that much faster when you're doing 25, 30, but it's still 2 knots. It's still a meter per second. So it's, you know, it's, if it lasts for 10 seconds, you're 10 meters ahead. And that's a pretty significant advantage at that point in the race.
That's right. That's right. I asked myself the question, if Jimmy hadn't have tried to draw that penalty, then, you know, almost certainly what would have happened is the Kiwis would have rolled over the top and they would have been forced into a slow tack away, which probably would have done about the same amount of damage. The other thing I was impressed with that situation was again, listening to the Kiwi on board the Kiwi boat, Glenn Ashby makes the call, you know, watch out for a big luff here. I mean, he obviously thought it was a viable option from Jimmy because he'd hung in till that point. And just how well they avoided that, really, because as you say, the margins are super tight. They don't have great visibility. And yes, they may have a camera, but I mean, a camera, we all know what it's like trying to back into a parking space using a camera. It's not that easy, is it? So, and there's no window in the main on the Kiwi boat, right?
Yeah, I think I heard a comment from Pete, one of the interviews, saying that they've also got Josh Jr. to leeward looking out for that as well. And helping out with that. I guess they've practiced it with the chase boat, but it's a bit different in when it's the real thing. But no, absolutely, I thought they managed it well. I don't know if they. It must be very difficult to judge. It's easy to judge whether the boats are going to hit or not, but when they add this extra diamond and then they add, what is it, 3 feet on top of that. That must be a very difficult thing to judge, actually, how close those perimeters are. So yeah, when we saw it from overhead on the live cameras, it looked like a big gap, didn't it? But as we say, the perimeter's actually got quite close. So nice job by Team New Zealand managing it. I think we might see some closer ones later on in the regatta, which will be interesting to see.
Oh my goodness, closer than that. That's something to look forward to. I think we also need to make the point here that when we see the skippers at the press conference, they have come straight from the boats and they haven't very likely had any chance to look at video or any sort of analysis of what's gone on. So when Jimmy was asked about that, he was probably feeling like, well, I don't know whether it was close or not close, you know? I mean, maybe he'd spoken to the umpires by then, I don't know. But he probably knew a little bit less than we did in terms of how close it was.
I find it hard to criticise somebody for a move that admittedly didn't come off, but if it had, it would have changed the race, and not going for it, you know, probably would have been the same outcome.
All right, so we're going to give him a thumbs up on that manoeuvre. Now, second race,
but not for the trigger pull.
but not for the trigger pull. Well, he didn't make that mistake in the second race. He was much more in control of things, wasn't he? What did you see on this one?
I was really surprised in this one how Team New Zealand set up for this lead follow. They telegraphed very early that they were going to go up and tack around. And that just meant that Luna Rossa were able to slow their jibe around, take their time on that, and actually waste a load more time before the lead follow really set up. And it's not a great spot to push from. Effectively, they were pretty much dead to windward of Luna Rossa trying to push, and it's not an easy spot to push from. In the press conference, Pete said they just needed to turn up a couple of seconds earlier. I don't buy that. I think if he really believes that, then I think he's kidding himself. Pushing, coming down to push like that from high up, you're pretty much committed until you've cleared the other boat, because if you start coming up before, they're in a great spot to luff you and probably push you off the foil. So, no, I think for me, that's a mistake. Maybe they know something I don't. That's very possible. But I was surprised to see them set up there. And I said to myself when they did it, I think they're going to struggle to get a start from here. And obviously, it was a clear win for Luna Rossa.
Yeah, and at that point, I mean, you heard the expletive, which I'm pretty sure was from Pete, because he knew it was pretty much all over. And they rolled into a, well, they don't roll these boats, do they? But they went into an early tack, and from then on, it was easy for the Italians just to put the hard cover on them and bounce them to the side of the race course that they chose. Race was over at that point, but it gives us a good kind of segue just into the concept of covering on these upwind legs. What have you seen about covering that maybe is different from the conventional boats that you've been kind of most experienced of racing in? The non-foiling boats, I mean.
Yeah, you know, not that much different, actually. I think the key thing is always the tack loss. You know, what is the tack loss? You know, can you put in a close cover? Can you put in a close lee bow? I think actually there was a really interesting one today. Was race four off the line when Luna Rossa had done two tacks, Team New Zealand had done one, and they were coming back, and the virtual eye had them, I think, 20 meters ahead. It looked like they had just a marginal cross, and they went for a lee bow and actually put it in pretty comfortably, it looked like. I think it's interesting that the VMG loss in the tacks is not during the tack, it's after the tack, because they come very low to build speed again. Particularly in the light, they come almost down to a beam reach to build. And that's where the loss is. So I think maybe that's one of the differences is sort of where the loss is and therefore where the positioning is. But no, I think it's interesting. Certainly these boats are losing less than if you go all the way back to sort of 2013, the catamarans, you know, huge loss in the tax, and therefore not really possible to cover in this way. These guys seem to be able to tack pretty short notice, which is important because you can respond to the other boat pretty effectively and safely as well. Early on in the Christmas race, I think you saw people bailing out of covering positions because they were nervous about the four alarm system working, or maybe making a mistake themselves, or whatever it was. They were nervous that a tack would mean the falling off the foils. Whereas I don't think you're seeing that now. I think you're seeing that the team's perfectly prepared to put the tack, the cover tack on, when they think it's the right thing to do.
Hi everybody, Justin Chisholm here. I hope you're enjoying this free episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast, and I'll let you get back to listening to it very soon. But I just wanted to take the chance to quickly plug our new exclusive member-only podcast, the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. That's where you can find in-depth interviews with some of professional yacht racing's top names. So far, my guests have included Russell Coutts, Chris Nicholson, Dee Kafari, Johan Richom, Justin Slattery, Matt Cornwell, Sam Goodchild, and Andrew Campbell. To listen, you need to subscribe, and it's just €5 per month or €50 per year. You can try before you buy with our free 14-day trial. To find out more, head over to yachtracingpodcastextra.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H. That's yachtracingpodcastextra.supercast.tech. Yeah, it seems like the crews now are really instinctively sailing these boats and can concentrate on just doing what they need to do on the race course, make those strategic and tactical decisions and make decisions on the fly as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think both these boats really have their helmsman doing the tactics, which, it's a big boat to do both jobs. I can't say that I know how much they're having to concentrate on the helming, or whether it's, obviously they've got other flight controls. I don't even know if they're adjusting the rudder, trim elevators or not, or how much they're having to do that. I don't know how much sort of, concentration goes into steering them. So it's hard to say, but it's always difficult to do both. You've got to be focused on speed at the right times. And I remember hearing Glenn Ashby say, let's make sure we're going fast here, at one point today. Which is a little bit of a kick to the helmsman, stop looking around and focus on speed. But that's inevitable. If you're trying to do both, it's not easy.
Yeah. For two very different styles, I think, between the crews, very much a kind of conversation very much people chipping in with information for Pete Burling on the Kiwi boat. And then it feels a little forced at times on the Italian boat, but they have this dialogue, kind of very reassuring dialogue between the two of them that everything's great.
Yeah, I think it needs to be. You have to, when you have this split helmsman set up like that, I think you have to have protocols, and you sort of got to have a fixed way of talking to make sure. Also, obviously, cross languages, Australian and Italian. But also changing in responsibilities. So you've got to make sure there's a completely common language. When one person's making a decision 1 minute and the other person the next minute, you've got to sort of nail down like I say, a common language. When you've got one guy making the decisions, it sort of works to have people either chipping in or not as they see fit. I think that can work as well. And it's obviously, I guess it's how Pete and Blair work on the 49ers. It's something that Pete will be very used to. He's responsible for the decisions with Blair Took, inputting where he feels able and confident to do so.
That's right. Now, let's take a look at today's racing. Friday, races 3 and 4. When I wrote my report, I called it a tale of two lee bows, and I think that's a fair description of it, because it was all about the power of the Libau tack, and we saw the Italians use it to great effect in the first race, and then the Kiwis returned the favour in the second race, but in two reasonably different scenarios. So can you cast your mind back to that first race this morning, Ian?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think of course, if and as I wrote in the piece that I did for you, if you can get a start separated to windward and hold all the way to the boundary, and tack effectively simultaneously. In fact, I think Luna Rosso actually turned slightly after Team New Zealand on that race one today, race three overall. If for Team New Zealand's position there, they're trying to build speed out of attack straight into the gas of Luna Rosso, it's a tricky spot. And so, yeah, absolutely, it was the Libau, but really it came down to the start. And it was an interesting one. The TV feed just panned away from Team New Zealand at the critical moment, but I think they maybe fell off the foils. When they round up, they tend to put both boards down for the roundup, and then they lifted the windward one at some point. I didn't see when, and they dropped down to about 18 knots, I think it was. And it looked like maybe they fell off the foil and had to come down to just rescue that situation. And that opened up the ley line. And you heard, I think it was James Spittle said, I think they're below ley line. What he means is the shutout ley line. So that means that they're Luna Rosso are now confident that they will be able to start to windward without being shut out of the line. And from that moment, they can forget about Team New Zealand, focus on their own start, just hitting the line as well as they can, separated to windward, and they did a nice job of that. They were bang on. I think they were pretty similar to Team New Zealand. I don't think there was, let me think, actually thinking back, I think Luna Rosso had a small speed edge at start time, not hugely significant, but certainly the separation they had to windward. And remember, it's such a short time in traditional America's Cup times. You'd have, 10 minutes on that board to try and squeeze the other guy off. And now what are they getting? A minute, maybe less if they're down near the pin. So you don't get a lot of time as that port boat, as that leeward boat, to work up and squeeze off the boat to windward. And obviously, which makes that separated to windward start very, very strong.
I heard Peter Burling say in the interview between races that we kind of changed our minds on that pin end start or something, like switched to the pin end start, which I felt like was a bit of a disguise for a mistake, and as you say, falling off the foils and ending up where the pin end was the only place they could start because they had to get going again and get sailing.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly chose the left side, didn't they, by leading back there. But yes, I think that was a slight hand, and it's a function of, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about 30% less area of the foils. It does seem that they obviously have maybe a slightly higher speed than Luna Rosso where they do fall off the foils. But at the same time, they're sailing their boat, so they've got to work out how to get that round up and nail that angle where they sail as high and slow as they can, but without falling off the foils there.
And that was pretty much it. The Italians were well separated up to windward. The boats, as you said, got to the boundary simultaneously tacked, although I agree with you, I think the Italians held on for an extra beat just to make sure they were right under the lee bow there. And then I guess people who sail conventional boats might ask the question, why didn't the Kiwis just tack away at that point and not suffer in the air? But that's not really possible in these boats, is it?
I'm actually not sure whether the option is to tack back. They certainly need to build, and it was, I think it was Paul Goodison mentioned, he thinks that the Kiwis need about 30 knots into the tack to have enough speed to get through without falling off on the other side. Whereas Luna Rosso can get away with 27 or 28, I think that's what he said. he certainly knows a lot more than I do. So I'll stick with what he said on that. You've also obviously got to consider there's the boundary there. So if you do tack away straight away, you're going to be, you know, the Luna Ross are going to come back again, and you're going to get pinned on that boundary. So it's a tricky spot to be in.
Yeah, that was effectively race over there. But let's talk a little bit about the downwind legs. The Kiwis always seemed like they were capable of coming back into the Italians on the downwind. And my feeling is that as the Italians are faster out of the tacks upwind, the Kiwis are faster out of the jibes and lower downwind. That's just my kind of feeling watching the racing. But I'm interested in knowing from you, when you're the trailing boat going downwind, what are you thinking about other than trying to catch the other guy? Because I heard Paul Goodison the other day, Lee McMillan in the helicopter say the downwind's all about setting up for the leeward gate and setting up for a split or you know, something kind of strategic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think what he's getting at really is that the lead tends to stretch out, of course, because the boats are going faster and they're sailing tighter angles downwind. So what are we seeing? If the lead's 100 meters at the top mark, it's normally 150 down the run. It's about a 50% extension. And I'm not entirely in agreement. We have seen passes downwind. We saw Luna Rossa pass Ineos downwind. Admittedly, Ineos had a fixed Cunningham. But if you do round opposite gates, you know, about the same time, then, you know, or the same gate, you know, right behind, I think there are opportunities to pass. But I think what he's getting at is in the majority of races, the lead boat is pretty safe down the run. And so what I think he's getting at there is you're trying to do the minimum of maneuvers and line yourself up for a nice easy rounding on, you know, on the gate that you want, which may be favored through bias or through going towards better pressure. You probably take the bias. It looks like they're able to do what they call the JK, the tack around the leeward gate. That actually looks to me like that might be slightly less than a full tack loss. Hard to judge, to be honest with you, because the distances are all changing around then anyway. But it looks like a pretty nice maneuver in these boats. And so if you set up for the favored gate in terms of distance to windward, you can then make a decision when you get there, you know, do you tack around it for pressure on the other side or carry on?
Yeah, it isn't. That's right. The split left and right between these two boys and the gates isn't so big that it's you're completely committed to one side or the other at that point.
No, and of course, yeah, as I say, you can tack around that gate pretty well if you want to go the other way. I mean, I still think there's tricky, but I think there's maybe a little bit more the at the start of the run. If you go around the same gate mark, I think there's quite a lot in how far that first boat goes before jibing. I think if they jibe in a good spot, they can make it really tricky for the boat behind to have a choice. Do they go past and risk ending up in the gas, or do they effectively end up jibing just slightly on your hip, and then you're nicely lined up to keep them in phase for the bottom? Because for sure, in an ideal world, you'd want the boat behind going around the same gate as you, just to narrow down the options. So there's a little bit there, I think, there's a little bit for the boat ahead, a little bit like the upwind, to be honest with you, in terms of trying to affect the boat behind's options. As we said, for the boat behind, you know, trying to just get some clear air, you know, maybe particularly in Team New Zealand's case, they do look like they've got an edge downwind. Again, I guess it's speculation, but it would be, an obvious thing that it's down to smaller foils. But you know what, it might be their rig, or it could be anything really, couldn't it? Really, as Lee says, I think setting up the passing opportunities do appear to be on the beat. The shifts, because you're sailing wider angles upwind than downwind, a shift in your favour will be a bigger difference. And so there's more opportunity. And also the tack loss is bigger than the jibe loss, which means that It's easier to cover downwind. It's easier to narrow down. If you want to narrow down the options, it's more comfortable to do an extra jibe because the loss is less than doing that extra tack.
Understood. Good insight. So the fourth race, the second race of today, that went the way of the Kiwis. And again, it was because of the power of the Lee Bow. Again, the skipper that made the mistake in the first race didn't make that mistake in the second race. It was, from my vantage point, it was a pretty good job by Burling, and maybe a little bit of a mistake from Jimmy Spithill on trying to go for a hook. But I'm interested to know what you thought of that manoeuvre, because he came a long way down to try and get that.
Well, yeah, I think this one was in the balance for a while. I think Team New Zealand did fall off the foils again. Same thing. They obviously, they jibed around at their timing, and Luna Ross obviously chose to go past and hip up, tack up, and attack from there. But at that point, they were above boat ley line. But again, Emirates Team New Zealand fell off the foils, and this time actually, I think they went all the way down to 15 knots. It was a full fall off, as it were. And I think, you know, they had then have to bear away hard, to build speed, and you've got to do that immediately. You can't just sit there off the foils because you're a sitting duck. And I think you're right. At that point, Spithill saw them off the foils, or somebody on board saw them off the foils, and they started to go for the hook. And you know, you could say give credit to Team New Zealand. Maybe they did it deliberately and knew that they could pop it back up, or maybe they got lucky. I don't know. But the way it worked out, Lunawasa came for the hook, and just at the right time, Emirates Team New Zealand popped back up, built. And then from that moment, they did a fantastic job of keeping it tight to leeward and hitting the line well. There's definitely no luck in that part. The last 15 seconds, you see Emirates Team New Zealand actually come right down to a broad reach, then all the way back up, hit the line. Whereas if you see Luna Rossa, they reach along the line a little bit more. And actually, that's closing the gap. And it's incredible. You know, it's difficult to do in a J80 what Pete Burling did. But, you know, to be honest with you, I think that was an incredible job from that moment, to be able to bear away that hard, come all the way that back up onto the wind, and keep that distance tight. So that was certainly a great job. But yeah, in hindsight, if Luna Rosso had hung to windward, as soon as Emirates Team Museum were off the foils, if Luna Rosso had hung to windward, it might have been that Emirates Team New Zealand would have been forced below the ley line just to keep the boat on the foils, in which case we could well have seen a similar start to race three. So yes, you could say that was perhaps a mistake by Spithill, but not easy for sure, and nobody, very hard to know whether that boat's gonna pop up. I mean, I think one of the interesting things, if we go back to the match racing tour, I mean, I don't know how many starts I've done on the World Match Racing Tour, how many done James Spithill has done, but in these boats, they've done very, very few of these. And these are fine judgment calls as to, you know, how the other boat is going to be able to respond. So they're definitely all learning. And I'm sure that, you know, that maybe not right now, what is it? It's midnight in New Zealand, but at some point before the next race, you know, both boats will be all over that and working out, how quickly they can pop back up and you know, what the right options are as a result.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, isn't it? Because as you say, they are learning as they go here, and we're all learning about these boats too. And we're watching two of the best people in the world, the people with the skills to sail these boats. And, you know, just to sail them in a straight line is remarkable, but also to be able to match race in them. And thank God we're seeing match racing as well. I mean, this is not drag racing. This is proper match racing, and at least in the pre-starts.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is proper match racing. I mean, some people are complaining that it's that it's going with the first cross. I'm trying to remember an America's Cup that didn't go you know, normally with the first cross. I doubt there has been one. There's a reason the first cross is powerful, not only because it's hard to pass, but also it's often the faster boat that gets the first cross. In this one, we've obviously seen it's gone 2-2, and so you know, I think you can say it's down to the start very much, which in many ways, I think is you know, for me as a match racer who's it's in some ways more interesting that it's very much down to the start. The first cross traditionally was, of course, partly down to the start, but it was also quite a lot down to who had the faster boat. For the reasons we've talked about, no boundaries meant, you know, and longer courses meant that you could, you know, if you were half a length behind off the line, you could 10 minutes on that board to squeeze them off or whatever it is. If you were a faster boat, you could wait, you could delay the first cross until your boat speed had got you ahead, hopefully. Whereas now you don't get that time. The first cross comes very soon in the race, so it really crystallizes the result of the start.
It does indeed. Now let's do a little crystal ball gazing, shall we? It's four races in, two races apiece.
It would be quite good to talk about that race four and just how it, because I think that was the closest one. Luna Ross attacked away reasonably early, and they were still, you know, in the race at that point. And I thought that was a very interesting first cross as Team New Zealand came back on port, Luna Ross on starboard. Now, I'd thought at the time that Team New Zealand should have tacked onto port earlier so that they're doing the lee bow while Luna Ross are still building speed out of their tack. That's probably what I would have done. Say that. I mean, I haven't sailed the boat, so I can't really say. But that looked like the right thing to do to me. Whereas obviously they gave that separation. But I thought it was really interesting that from a what looked like a pretty marginal cross, they were able to make that lee bow stick. And I thought that was, you know, considering we're talking about 50 or 70 meter tack losses, That's a really interesting dynamic that I think, you know, will be interesting to see how that goes forward, and whether that continues to be the same or whether maybe we're misreading it. Maybe they were crossing by further than it looked to us.
Yeah, I think you're right, and you're right. We should talk a bit more about this. From what I saw was throughout this race was that the two boats have. They end up with similar performance, but they get there in a different way. So the Kiwis are sailing slightly lower and at a speed upwind, and the Italians are sailing slightly higher and possibly slightly slower, but the VMG ends up the same. On that lee bow tack, I think because the Kiwis had nobody in front of them at that point, that, you know, they were able to build their speed and not struggle, but still be giving the dirty air to the Italians. Have I got that anywhere close to right?
Yeah, I mean, it's look, what do we know? We're just watching on TV. It might have looked like a closer cross because Team New Zealand were pressing down for speed for the tack. So you know they're winding up the rubber band at that point. So I guess there's a lot of nuances aren't there that we probably. You know, it's hard to pick up on, but I just thought that it was interesting that they were, you know, able to do that. One of the commentators did pick up on the commentary that the first tack away by Luna Rossa looked tough because they were tacking out of, you know, a down speed position. I didn't spot that, but I think you know, that lured. I wouldn't change the analysis that I'd put in my article, which is if you can squeeze, you know, if you can start to leeward and squeeze the other boat off before the boundary, then you're going to generally be in a strong position.
Yeah, that's something for us to watch out for in subsequent races. I do think we should do a little crystal ball gazing.
Yep.
Ian.
No, fine.
Because you're right. What do we know? We're only sitting here watching it. Well, you know a lot more than I do. But that's why I invited you on the podcast. So here's my hypothesis. We've seen the boats race on Wednesday in what I describe as medium air, 10 to 15, although I did hear 17. I didn't see 17s when I rewatched it. When I think the Italians were making the case that the Kiwis should have destroyed them because this is windy stuff and their smaller foils should give them an advantage. Now we've seen them race in sub-10 knot breezes where the Kiwis could make the case that the Italians should have destroyed them. But we've ended up with the point split half and half, and both teams, when they've won races, have looked good for winning them. They haven't fluked them. They haven't sneaked them. There's been no major breakdowns or problems. So can we expect more of the same, or are we waiting for the breeze to get above 17 knots and get into the kind of 17, 18, 19, 20 knot range when the Kiwis are suddenly going to turn it on? Yeah, just pick the bones out of that if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, you're asking me to predict the score, are you? What do we know? What don't we know? I mean, we know that the Kiwis have smaller foils, and as a result of knowing that, I think a lot of the focus of everybody has been on that. What do we suspect? Well, we suspect the Kiwis have more writing moment. I'm sure they know it. I'm sure both teams know it. Maybe there's commentators who know it, but I'm not sure. I believe that, but I'm not sure. There's speculation about lower. The sailors are obviously tucked away a little bit more on Team New Zealand. You know, does that give them less aero drag? Team New Zealand have the tip of their foil coming out. You know, what's that doing? Is that giving them less? Well, obviously, it's giving them less surface area, but is that the advantage? You know, they're going to get at high speed, and you know, there's a whole lot of things that we probably haven't even thought about, and don't really get into. So it's interesting to speculate. I don't think there's much doubt that Luna Rossa is a light air moded boat. I think that's a pretty safe assumption. They're gonna, if we get light air over the weekend, they're gonna be desperate to get a 2-0 day, while it's light air, because this is New Zealand, so it's gonna change. I haven't seen the forecast for early next week, but it normally does change in New Zealand over a pretty short time frame. So yeah, I think we can say that Luna Rossa are going to be pretty desperate to try and get a two win day on the board. And I think they're going to be focusing a lot on how do you disrupt the port entry boat? How do you make it difficult for them? They're not far away. I think today we talked about had Spittal not gone for that, not pushed, maybe he could have got a separated windward starter. I'm not sure about that. Likewise, on day one, they led back, but then didn't quite execute that from a difficult position. But that trigger pull. So yeah, I think they're going to be focusing on how they can disrupt that and get that first cross because it didn't look, did it today, like either boat would overtake. I think as soon as it gets windier, overtaking will be more easy, and particularly if it gets more shifty, if they come inshore and it gets more shifty. But even in windier conditions, the gas tends to dissipate much quicker. I think the pre-start, the tight leeward won't be quite so strong. The pre-start timing will be more difficult to dominate in the breezy stuff. And we also expect Team New Zealand to have a pretty significant speed edge, or certainly a speed edge, put it that way, in the breeze. So, the best chance of a pass is breezy, shifty conditions with Team New Zealand behind. And I think if you had, four races like that, I would expect Team New Zealand to pass in at least one of them. But yeah, I guess we're waiting to see, aren't we? I think what will be really interesting to see is in those sort of conditions is the pressure coming on Luna Rossa decision making. If they're ahead and Team New Zealand, in breeze and shifty, and Team New Zealand have that bit of an edge, if Luna Rossa sell perfectly, then they probably won't get past. But, you know, yeah, sailing perfectly tactically in those conditions with gates is very challenging.
Yeah, I agree. And that brings me nicely on to something I just wanted to ask you to kind of finish us up here. An enormous amount of pressure on everybody on all of these boats, but on focusing in on the helmsman too. I mean, you're a match racing skipper. You've been in these high pressure situations. And one of the things I've heard people like you say is you've got to just move on from the previous race. You're always focused on the race that is in front of you and not worry about, you know, not celebrate the win, not worry about the loss. As the series goes on, the pressure mounts on the helmsman, doesn't it? Can you give us some idea what that must be like?
I think the dynamic in the America's Cup is quite different to a match race regatta. You know, for us, we're going into a final and it's getting done. It's a 2-hour time slot and at the end of that 2 hours, there's going to be a winner, 3 hours or whatever it is. But you know, whereas the America's Cup, it's two races a day. You know, you get over, you know, you get a break. We've often seen it on match race. If you go in 2-0 and then have an overnight break, it's pretty 50-50 who wins the next day, because it's amazing how that break allows the boat that's down to regroup. So I think these two race days, the dynamic of that is really interesting, and you can split it into each day, I think, particularly with the way the pressure builds. You lose the first race, the pressure is on you for the second race, I think, to not have a 0-2 day. Particularly the longer it goes on, if it carries on at 1-1, then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it's a little bit like a break of serve in tennis, isn't it? You know, in fact, they play to six, don't they? But you've got to be two ahead. So, you know, it's about the same numbers. You could think of it as and if you do go a break down, then you probably start, you know, swinging for the corners a little bit more, trying to get it back. So I think it will be really interesting to see that, particularly if it keeps going 1-1, to see that pressure mount and see how the teams respond to that. They seem like pretty cool customers, don't they? But it's a big deal, the America's Cup.
It really is, and I guess the Italians can split it between two helmsmen. Jimmy's certainly got the experience. I think Francesco's feeling the pressure of, you know, the possibility of being the first Italian skipper to lift the cup. That must be big. But he's a pro too, and as you say, Burling is. People have been coming to me just how ice cold he is about the whole thing. I mean, he's, I guess his Olympic training and experience has delivered for him on that side of things. If you had to make a prediction, Ian, what would it be for the next couple of days and what we expect to be light stuff?
In the light stuff, it's probably a bit of a cop out to say it'll go 1-1 each day, but you know, but it's it does, you know, I think they look pretty even in the light. I think that it is one mistake, isn't it, that decides each race, and actually in some ways that takes the pressure off. It's what I found, you know, with pressure in a final of a match race tour event is it's, you know, what you make a mistake and that puts your pressure on you going forward. And then maybe you make another one and then, you know, it sort of builds like that. Whereas if it's one mistake a race, you've got one mistake to recover from, you can often do that. But yeah, having said that, it's obviously the boats are challenging. If you fall off the foils, it can be a big in the pre-start. It can be a big and Team New Zealand do seem, we saw it in Christmas race as well, and fall off the foils a couple of times. They do seem to have a tendency to do that. So that's something that they're going to have to really be on top of. And you know, that for me, that will be Lunawas's opportunity to get a 2-0 day is if Team New Zealand, you know, have that sort of mistake. But then, going into the rest of the America's Cup, I think, if and when the breeze gets stronger, I think all of a sudden the pressure will then go back on, the pressure's always on the slower boat, because you've got to make something happen. If you don't, you're probably going to get overrun. And so if, as we expect, we don't know, but as we expect, Team New Zealand end up faster in the breeze, I think it will be interesting to see if James Spittle's able to exert that pressure back, and try and force, Team New Zealand into the mistakes.
Well, we shall just have to wait and see. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating series. It's fascinating to watch. And this has been really, really useful and really interesting. I think it'll give people some good insight, Ian. So thank you for your expert input and for spending what's just close to an hour with me. Wasn't supposed to be this long, but it's been really good. So maybe we can tempt you back later in the series. We'll see. But for now, Ian, thanks a million for spending the time with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Justin. I've enjoyed it, and I'm just really looking forward to the rest of the series. I think we're every day now, aren't we, till the end? So I'm going to keep the 6 a.m. alarm going, and you'll be pretty tired if you're getting up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. every morning by the end of it, I suspect. But it should be a good ride.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Thanks to match racing expert Ian Williams for his time and for his expert insight. I'll be back soon with another free episode. And in the meantime, don't forget to head over to the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra for a free trial. The web address is in the show notes.